What is peace brain? Peace brain is the synergistic connection between our mental and emotional bodies, blending the electrical power of the mind with the magnetic force of the heart. Listen and explore how to create unity worldwide as we blend science and metaphysics, open our hearts and minds to the possibilities of peace on Earth, and create the life we are each destined for. Featured guests range from angel communicators to zoologists and everything in between. Now here is your host, Dr. Gail Lash.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Peace Brain Show. This is your host, Dr. Gail Lash, and we're happy to have you here today. Today, we have a fun topic talking about zoo veterinarians and their stories sort of how about all the animals in the zoo. So I'm very happy we have our guest here, Dr. Michael Berry, and we'll bring him on in just a minute, but we'll talk about peace through zoos and health and all of those good things. So stay tuned for that. And, of course, also stay tuned to the end of the show, and we have our Peace Brain Meditation, which I hope you enjoy and use in your daily life. And, as always, I open the show with a quote. And today I have a wonderful quote by Albert Einstein, which I really enjoy. And he says this, "A human being is part of the whole called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts, and feelings as separate from the rest, as kind of an optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its bounty." So what I like about this quote from Albert Einstein is that he really is pointing out that we're not these separate beings, we're not these little enclaves of our families and our friends, that we really do exist in connection to all things, and particularly in connection to all creatures, all animals and plants on the face of the earth, and to everything that is living, and that all of nature should really be regarded in this form of oneness and working together with the human race. So take a breath and really think about yourself as part of this whole. It really is important that we're not just these urban dwellers, as most of us are on the planet, that there is this beautiful nature around us, not only in our front or backyards with the trees and the birds and the squirrels or whatever animals you happen to have in your particular neighborhood, but also all the wild creatures that exist outside of our urban environments, that are in these wild places. And many times they are actually, I want to say, going extinct. They're actually really being threatened by our human development. And this is obviously a world global issue of how can we have our human developments and then still have these beautiful animals and creatures that exist on the planet with us. And this is where zoos and aquariums come in. That I know there's a lot of controversy perhaps around zoos and aquariums, but the good ones, the ones that are ethical, the ones that keep animals in these beautiful natural habitats and in natural groupings and really seek to protect these animals and use their resources to also fund conservation in the wild, in the countries that these animals come from. These places, these zoos and aquariums, are places where people can really get a glimpse. They can have that personal experience with animals that they may never see, that someone in a city may never get to go to Africa or to Indonesia or over to Australia to really see these animals up close and personally. So it's important to support your zoo and aquarium and to really begin to realize that these educational messages are here to bring us back to what Albert Einstein is saying we really must take into consideration, that we must look at the earth as one living being, and that we are part of nature, and that we're not separate from all of these different elements on the planet. So with that, that quote introduces us to what we're going to be talking about today on the Peace Brain Show, and that is some wonderful stories of animals in zoos and aquariums, and by our wonderful guest, Dr. Michael Berry, who is a zoo veterinarian, or has been for the last 32 years. He actually retired in 2015, but he still is an occasional relief veterinarian for several zoos around the United States. And he happens to be here in Atlanta, Zoo Atlanta, for a few days right now over this holiday season and helping the veterinarians there and take care of the animals. He graduated from Michigan State University and worked as a zoo vet at the Columbus Zoo, the Oklahoma City Zoo, and the Philadelphia Zoo for many years. He was an executive board officer of the American Association of Zoo Veterinarians for 4 years and on the Animal Health Committee of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums for 17 years. So he has quite extensive experience with zoo animals, wild animals in these urban environments. And right now, as a retired zoo vet, he is enjoying grandparenting and playing music, beekeeping, mead making, and reading. So, Michael, I want to welcome you to the Peace Brain Show.
Thank you, Gail. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, great to have you here and to, again, talk about zoos. I know we've done that a couple of times on the Peace Brain Show. And as you know, that's something that is one of my passions, is working with zoos and aquariums around the world. So how did you get involved in animals in the first place? How did you become a veterinarian, or what sort of put you on that path?
Well, I think, you know, you go back to childhood, and I was the kid that was out wading through swamps catching frogs and getting bit by water snakes and, you know, trying to catch critters. My parents were were good sports about it, I suppose I could say. And sometimes we would, I have three brothers and a sister, and amongst us we would, you know, sometimes get our hands on, say, a snake from out of the woods, and we'd bring it home, and they'd let us keep it for a while, and then and then turn it loose, you know. And so so with that exposure, you know, I always enjoyed that. And then through my undergrad career, I was a zoology major and took all the requisite courses that, you know, ornithology and herpetology and, you know, studies of reptiles and et cetera. And, you know, my interest just, you know, continued from there. Somewhere along the line, I thought veterinary medicine would be a good fit for me, and I wasn't the youngest person in my class. Actually, I was one of the older people because I took a few extra years trying to getting around to, to getting into school and et cetera. I was sort of a lame duck graduate student for a year, et cetera. And in vet school, I was one of the, it's my impression that in any veterinary class, there's a handful of five or six students that are kind of zoo-y, and those are the ones that have pet snakes and, you know, are interested in birds and interested in, you know, non-domestic veterinary medicine. And I was one of those people. In my class, I'm the only one that made it into zoo work. I think, you know, when I finally got out of school and into the real working world, it was about the time when it struck me that I should pursue something that I really loved. And
good
so,
point.
Yes, instead of being a small animal veterinarian, which was fine, I enjoyed that. For a few years, I was in small animal practice. But during that time, I started pursuing trying to get into some zoo residency training programs, and I was able to do that at the Philadelphia Zoo, and that put me into the zoo practice world.
Mm-hmm. It is difficult. Well, I won't use the word difficult, maybe, but there's not many positions. In other words, it's a limited field to get into this exotic animal medicine. So
it is, but I spent one of my externships when I was a senior at an equine hospital because I was curious about equine medicine, and mm-hmm. so I wanted to spend some time getting exposed to that. And I remember speaking to one of the owners there when he was asking me what my plans were, and I said some comment about there's probably a saturation in the equine vet market. I didn't really know for sure, but I said, there might be plenty of equine vets. And he made a comment that stuck with me, and that he said, well, there's always room for another good one.
Hmm. That's a great statement.
Yeah, I know. Very profound. I thought, wow, that is that's actually true for anything that anyone wants to do.
That's true.
There's always room for another good person, another mm-hmm. person that does, that does a good job. So mm-hmm. I've passed that along to the students when I'm trying to give them sage advice about careers and whatnot. I usually throw that zinger at them because it just seemed like a great thought to me.
It is a great thought. And I love that you had said to yourself that you wanted to do something that you really enjoyed. Because that, too, is another great thought of sage advice for anyone out there looking for a new career.
Mm-hmm. And it is true that there are a limited number of positions. If you wanted to be a clinician in a zoo, there are only a finite number of zoos and a finite number of zoo veterinary positions in those zoos. And so there's only a few hundred of full-time zoo veterinarians in the country. But I never discouraged anyone that really wanted to do it. I always used myself as an example because I wasn't the scholastic powerhouse that some of my colleagues in school were. But if they were willing to put the work in and stick with it and work hard, then they really could accomplish whatever it is they wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. And do most zoos have kind of an externship, I guess I'll call it, for people in veterinary medicine?
A lot of zoos have student programs where they will bring a student in for a month or 2 months. Oh, and usually this is the program we had, we would bring senior students in. So often 2 years out, we would start getting letters from veterinary students saying, do you have an externship
right.
possibility? And then, that was one of the things that I did, was one of the responsibilities that fell to me was filling that, because we really only took one student on at a time. So,
mm-hmm. right.
so we had to kind of get them into blocks and have them lined out. When I retired, I was a year and a half out on scheduling students, so I had already scheduled into 2017. So some of the students that came through in the past year at the Columbus Zoo, I had scheduled.
mm-hmm.
So they were already on
wow.
the list when I left.
So for someone wanting to get into zoo veterinary medicine, your path that you took was to what? Get a degree in biology and then
I got a bachelor's degree in zoology, and
mm-hmm.
And that in terms of doing zoo work helped a great deal because of the just the background in taxonomy and physiology and the differences mm-hmm. in systems and
right.
And also, I think that on the personal side, the wonderment of all that, the different adaptations that all these different animals have for the environment that they, have evolved to fill. And so, working with bats, for instance, and they've got wings, but the wings are made out of skin. and their the bones in their wings are their finger bones that are the same as the finger bones in, you know, analogous to the bones in our hands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first time that I had the opportunity to do a postmortem exam on a dolphin, it was the first time I had actually looked down the blowhole, and I noticed that there are actually two holes. And the revelation came to me, and you know, because I had never thought about it before, that's the blowhole is actually is actually the nostrils that have moved to the top of the head, and that's probably not horribly profound, but it would at the moment, you know, a long time ago when I first noticed that, it was just part of the. Part of the excitement, I guess, about the work.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it wasn't just about it wasn't just about the medical conditions or keeping the animals healthy. It was really the anatomy fascinated you, and the
yeah.
adaptations of ecology of the ecological systems that these animals came from.
Very much so.
Hmm.
Very much so.
Interesting. Interesting. You know, I think back at my degrees, and I had a degree in zoology as well, and thought about going into veterinary medicine, but I didn't really want to work with sick animals. So
mm-hmm.
I stayed on the well side of animals and went into animal behavior. But that's
yeah.
interesting to think, to hear you say, I mean, I too was fascinated by the ecology and the adaptations and how similar and yet different all these species are. So
yeah.
I see where you're coming from. Yeah, awesome.
And you know, we do a lot of work on healthy animals as well. I mean, they're not
true.
All in trouble when we get our hands
true.
On them. They may think they're in trouble, but they're not all.
Right.
You know.
So talk about that for a minute, the wellness program in zoos.
Okay. Let's see. Where do I start?
I know it's a big field.
Yeah, of course, preventative medicine philosophically would be preferred to what you might say is fire engine medicine, or, you know, putting out fires.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can, you know, anticipate issues or do preventative things like vaccinations, which we do a lot of in zoos, and parasite control, which, again, we spend a lot of our time monitoring our charges for parasites and treating those that have issues. Those are all things you do ahead of the game. Some animals need regular hoof trims in order to stay healthy, or sometimes need their teeth worked on. We often will bring in a human dentist for our primate exams, and they can do a comprehensive dental exam at the time while we have these animals under anesthesia, and that's all just trying to stay out ahead of you know, problems.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times, wild animals will hide their problems until they're you know, very far down the road to illness, and we like to stay on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so parasite monitoring, routine physical exams. Some zoos, and I've had programs that have kind of gotten. We've kind of gone, swung the pendulum both ways on whether an immobilized, you know, an anesthesia procedure for a routine exam. In other words, a procedure where you can get a blood sample, you can do a hands-on physical. With some animals, that's a bigger deal than with others. It has varied over the arc of my career whether we've done that more aggressively or less aggressively.
Mm-hmm. Have you done some training then with animals, different species, to present for blood draw and exams?
Yes, and you know, I'll say that the animal care people, the keepers and the curators that take care of animals in zoos, are really the most dedicated people that I've that I know. They are the ones that call the veterinarian down to look at something, and I've been amazed at how the keeper even noticed there was a problem in the first place. You know, say, you know, there's a bump on this animal inside this animal's leg, and there's no way you can even see that bump. So, well, how did you even see that? You know, or this animal always does this behavior, and for the last 2 days it has stopped, you know, even though it's done it that way for 6 years. And so they're very tuned into their animals. They care a great deal about them. They're kind of like the owners. If you use an analogy of a small animal practice, you know, those care people are the owners that you know, you work on, you know, veterinarians work on animals, but their owners are really their clients.
Yes, it's true.
Except that in the zoo setting, we all have to get along because we have to come back to work the next day and all work together. So,
yep.
Yeah.
And you're right. The keepers notice the littlest things. And I know that when I was an animal keeper for a while, and I've really tuned into my, you know, the animals I was working with, particularly the orangutans. They were so intelligent and so easy to read, you know, to have a nonverbal conversation with, basically, and know if something was off or not.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the animal care people are a limitless resource in terms of helping you, you know, take care of the health needs as a veterinarian. We'll have ideas on how we might proceed with an issue, you know, with some animal or another, and present that to the keepers. You might see their eyes wide and open and go, "You want to do that?" or they might say, "Well, here's why that will work or why that won't work." Or they may come up with their own ideas, which are sometimes very creative. Mm-hmm. And so it's really they're a delightful group of people to work with because they're so passionate about what they do, and there's so much enjoyment in it.
Well, I remember when we had some trainers come in and work with our animals when I worked at the Los Angeles Zoo, to train particularly the primates to present for blood draws and even do an ultrasound on a small primate, a small monkey, to see if they were pregnant. And it was really amazing to have that kind of cooperation from the animal and make it really easy for everyone.
And I think that type of training is enriching for the animals. Mm-hmm. You know, it presents them with something to think about and a problem to solve, which is how you end up training them. You know, all of it has to be volunteer on the animal side.
Yeah.
None of it is forced.
So
if they don't want to do something, they don't do it. And I think that zoos in general, we could get a lot farther with that if we had the staffing.
That's true.
Most of the limitations on training, I think, come down to whether zoos can afford to pay the staff to do that.
To take the time to do that, because it does take a lot of time out of one's day to work with the animal one-on-one, absolutely. Although more and more researchers are coming in now and doing those types of cognitive training, and they are certainly, it's enrichment with the animals, but also training is involved in it, so
yes,
that can be combined
and
as well.
It's been amazing to me what some keepers, reptile keepers, have been able to do with some reptile species that you wouldn't think have any intellect, or, you know, any intellectual capacity that can figure out simple target training. And I've talked to some keepers that know this intuitively because they've done it even though they haven't been part of a program or anything.
Mm-hmm. You know? So give us an example, if you have one on the top of your head.
I had a keeper tell me a story. Once he used to take care of some, I don't remember which species it was, but they were crocodiles.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to open up, there was like a wall and a Dutch door sort of opening, and he used to feed them through there. And the crocodiles, you know, kind of got associated the door opening with food. So they would, like, charge the door. So what he did is he had just a stick, basically. What he started doing was he would open the door, and they would bite on the stick and realize it wasn't food. Mm-hmm. So they learned that not all the time the door opened were they going to be fed. And he said they got to the point to where he opened the door, and they would look, and he would show them the stick, and then they go, oh, he's not going to feed us. And so they actually looked for the stick, and if there was a stick, they'd go, oh, it's no big deal. If it was feeding time, then they would get fed. But you wouldn't think that crocodiles would have the capacity to, you know, to make that, you know, distinction.
That's a great story. Yeah, the animals are a lot more intelligent, I think, than we typically give them credit for. It's pretty amazing. Obviously, crocodiles in the wild have to make decisions, but we're not thinking on those lines of what a daily life of a crocodile would be.
Yeah,
the types of things
I know.
That he or she would notice. Yeah.
Yeah, so. And their whole universe of sensation and environment is very different than ours. You know what
it's
they
true.
Perceive, not just crocodiles, but really all different species.
That's true. A lot more relies on maybe temperature or different wavelengths of light or all kinds of things that we don't necessarily pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So. Give us a story about maybe one of your favorite animals to work on, or maybe an interesting story of, I don't know, you choose, a veterinarian story.
You know,
that you choose to share.
I think if you ask any zoo veterinarian, they will tell you that they have the same experience that I have had, and that is when you tell someone you're a zoo veterinarian, they immediately say, are you a veterinarian for all the animals at the zoo? I think it's just a natural place your mind goes, because the animals are so different, you know.
That's true.
And then the other question they have, which is a little toward your question to me, is what's your favorite animal? And, you know, through most of my career, I've been unable to answer what's my favorite animal. Because it's just, you know, they're all so very different, and they're all enjoyable and different for different reasons. Mm-hmm. But I will say that if you really held my feet to the fire, I'd have to say great apes. And if you made me refine it more than that, I'd have to say gorillas. I've had a lot of experiences with gorillas. Some were, you know, and with other great apes, they were pretty remarkable. Anecdotal stories. I had a gorilla named Lulu, who's passed away now after many years, and she had an abscess in her abdomen that required surgery. And prior to this, I'd known her for years. I was her doctor. And she was a kind of a grumpy gorilla that you never really particularly, you know, once she figured out I was a veterinarian, she wasn't really ever happy to see me.
It's true. The animals do not like the vets at the zoo.
Yeah, sometimes they, well, unfortunately, you have to kind of, you know, you're the strange person that comes in and you know, sometimes inflicts pain on them, and they don't know why.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But. Yeah, so Lulu had surgery, and she had to stay up at our hospital. She needed medication, so we had her in a gorilla-sized squeeze cage for about a week after her surgery, because she needed injections post-surgically. And so while she was up there, I saw her more, and she's sort of in solitary confinement up there while we're waiting for her to get better. But I also would give her treats. In particular, I'd give her Twizzlers that I would sneak in and would hand to her. And I don't know if it was the Twizzlers or just that I was someone that she was lonesome up there and got to where she liked seeing me. But from that time on, for the rest of her life, she was always delighted to see me come in the building.
Wow.
And this included, you know, there were times when I had to dart her and for mobilization purposes, you know, which she didn't like, but that didn't mean she stopped liking me later, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, it was kind of rewarding. And I've had a few animals that have sort of bonded with me that, you know, expressed affection in one way or the other. We have an old penguin who's still at the zoo in Columbus that calls when he hears my voice in the building.
Hmm. Wow. That's really great.
Yeah, and the other, you know, penguins require beak trimming from time to time, and most of them you have to wrap in a towel and you know, hold them down, and then you have to hold them their head very still because they bite very hard, and they move their, you know, they catch fish underwater, so they can move very fast, and they really give you a real pinch. But with JB is the penguin's name, I could just pick him up and set him on the table, and he was just like a puppy dog. And literally, I could take a Dremel tool and hold onto his beak and trim his beak with dust flying all over the place, and he just tolerating it, you know. And I just thought it was amazing, you know.
He clearly appreciated or knew what you were doing, knew the procedure, and knew that you were helping in some way.
Well, I don't want to presume. He knew
yeah, well,
why,
that's true.
Why
we
that
don't
going,
know, but
he didn't care. You know,
he
was
care.
Calm. Yeah, he was
yeah.
trusting enough to tolerate what manipulations I did with him. You know,
kind of like the dog that will lay there and let you Dremel their nails.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Very much so. Yeah.
Well, I know that it's very easy to get close to the animals when one works with them at a zoo or aquarium.
Mm-hmm.
So are there, I guess, how can the public learn from that closeness of either a keeper or a veterinarian or a curator and really appreciate who the animal is and what it's doing at the zoo for the general public?
Wow. I'm not sure I know.
I'm wondering, is it through stories? Obviously, the public is able to get close up to some animals in some instances, but by and large, obviously, the public is kept at a short distance or medium
distance
from safe distance is a better way to put
yeah.
it, yes, from the animals. But you obviously are getting up close and personal to these
mm-hmm.
animals. So what's the feelings or difference in that experience versus what the public might feel that you could share?
I think that what the public, what anybody would responds to are stories.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can tell them stories that give a, you know, that they can get personally involved in, I think that their feelings about the animals could be much deeper, you know, than they are if they just sort of take a look at, you know, if a keeper comes out and keepers do this regularly at zoos, they come out front and give keeper talks, or they'll answer questions. You know, a lot of the people that come to the zoo really do want to know the personal lives of these animals and their personalities and information about them. And I think that goes a long way. I've always thought that, you know, part of my responsibility, I guess, at the zoo was to talk with the public. And so if I was out on grounds working and I got asked questions, I'd always try to take the time to answer people's questions and try to tell them something that was interesting about, you know, whatever it was that we were involved in.
Mm-hmm. That's excellent. Because you're right. Keeper talks and information from staff and particularly the veterinarians as well and the curators is really valuable
mm-hmm.
to the visitors, absolutely.
Yeah. And I agree with your opening comments about zoos in that I do think that there's a need for zoos in terms of people need that personal experience to care. And in order, you know, I mean, all of us, especially the people that work in zoos, are very passionate about endangered species and preserving and saving, reversing the course of animals that are disappearing on the planet. I mean, you won't find a more passionate group of people than people that work in zoos on those issues. And I believe that people's personal experience when they behold an animal, when they visit a zoo, has a lot to do with helping them understand how important they are and to care enough that those animals continue to exist.
It's true. It's true. We have a long way to go in zoos, but it's come so far from what it used to be, the menagerie and animals, single animals in cages lined up in a king's, you know, courtyard, that really these stories of the wild and how to protect them is so important. And to bring in the people from those areas also is really important. In other words, it's not just, obviously conservation issues are really about how humans are using the planet, not so much about the animals themselves.
I agree. You know, we had a keeper who's now he's now at a different zoo, and he is from Uganda, had come to the United States, and he was a gorilla keeper, and he started a program. When he went home to visit Uganda, he realized that the people that lived right outside the parks, many of them never saw any of the animals or were not familiar with. It's kind of counterintuitive, but they just didn't know anything about the animals except the ones that showed up on their plate for dinner. And so he started a program where he went back to Uganda and went to schools and talked about animals, brought pictures, showed them things. And these were animals that actually lived, you know, only so many miles away from their villages. And you've probably heard it, and I know other people, you know, have heard it, that, you know, a lot of people that live in East Africa have never seen a lion, you know, and it's kind of like whether you've ever seen a raccoon or not, you know.
Right.
Yeah, or an otter. And his program, last time I heard about it, it's been a little while now, but I assume he's still doing it, had to expand it into tens and tens of schools, you know, 30, 40 schools that he visited every year, and presented programs so that they could learn about the animals that were right in their midst. And that's so important if you want those people to care, you know, about
which is,
you know,
really the most important people to care because
it
they
seems
live
like
with
it. Yes, it seems like it very much.
If we don't value the animals that are right around us, then they don't stay around. I mean, people, obviously human development is taking over the world and that's a whole nother conversation in and of itself, but the way that we develop the planet for our human species and our cities and our towns and our factories is really important to do it in concert with the land and in concert with the animals. And
I agree. I hope that the consciousness of our species can catch up to that in time. Because, you know, in my career, I think we've continued to lose ground. You know, even though when I was in high school during the first Earth Day, there were people of the generation ahead, you know, older than me, that said, you know, we've already blown it. It's up to you guys to save the planet, you know. And, you know, most of the focus was on pollution and whatnot back then. And now we're still saying that to our younger generation. So we've got a long way to go, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do. We certainly do. And I know that zoos and aquariums can be those places where people not only can come to learn about the animals, but can perhaps even have dialogue about what are the solutions to really coexisting with the earth and her creatures.
I hope creatures. So. I hope so.
So we're getting, well, we have another 5 minutes or so before we get into the Peace Brain meditation. So What other wonderful stories would you like to share?
I'm not sure. You know, when zoo veterinarians get together, you know, when you get a group of five or six zoo veterinarians, they start telling humorous stories of animals waking up unexpectedly.
Well, that would be, yes, quite an eye-opener.
but that's all just kind of part of the, you know, part of what, if that's what you do for a living, then once in a while you get surprises. Most
I guess
all
the surgeon
of them
might have the
end
same
well.
Story. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have my share of humorous, you know, things where somebody sat up when they weren't supposed to and, you know, caused momentary excitement or, you know, gorillas arriving in a truck and they're supposed to be in a crate, but one of them was not in a crate. It had gotten itself out of the crate, you know. And, you know, stories like that.
Stories like that. What about some miracle stories of animals that you were really happy could continue on, or just some really wonderful?
Well,
I'm thinking like, you know, like if I had a three-legged dog, in other words, and they, you know, won a obedience contest or a agility contest or something.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of success stories, and you know, we certainly have our share, because that's what we do as veterinarians. We have our share of sad stories that don't end well. You know, no animal lives forever, and so, you know, part of what we do in our lives is to work with and sometimes share the sadness of having to say goodbye to, you know, some of our favorite animals. And that certainly in the, you know, course of my career, I've had to do that many times and share in the sadness of the people, you know, that I work with. But on the other hand, there's other times where we've had some pretty serious cases that we were able to muster the right specialist to come in. You know, one nice thing about zoo veterinary work is that the animals you work on are so interesting that it's relatively easy to find specialists in human medicine or in veterinary medicine. And these are like surgeons or oncologists or ophthalmologists or whatever. It's relatively easy, it has been in my career, to find one of those specialists willing to come in and help you just for fun.
Yes, yes.
To them, it's a nice change. Actually, our family dentist was asking me about my work, and he said, you know, if you ever need me, give me a call. And so I called him, and he just brought all kinds of equipment with him and brought support staff, and we've done root canals on gorillas with him. And,
oh, my.
You know, and there was a rather complicated medical case we had, again, with a gorilla that we had several human radiologists and oncologists and endocrinologists, and also a component of, because in Columbus we live close to the veterinary school, we're able to tap into the specialists that are there as well.
Yes.
And you know, if you can arrange a time when they can come, often it's just great. You know, the zoo vets are specialists in immobilizing, and then we can hand them off to, you know, and collaborate with them on the differences between, you know, a human and a gorilla. You know, the human will say, oh, well, just have them do this. And they say, well, we can't have them do that, you know, because they're a gorilla, not a human, you know.
Right. You know. But you're right, a lot of it crosses species. And even something not so close as a primate and a human. But I'm sure even when you get into other taxa that are quite different from humans, even the human procedures could be used.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And as a result, I've been able to, you know, be involved in some real interesting cases that, you know, I otherwise would not have seen, just because, you know, I could get some specialist people, you know, involved that really had some really sharp skills, and that were really great help to us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a common thing in zoos.
How does this information or these specialist treatments actually help conservation of these species in the wild?
Well,
is some of it applicable to that too?
I think the bigger question is how does the animals that live at the zoo help the species in the wild?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And if you can answer that one, then the other answer is easy. maintaining their health and well-being. If their existence in zoos is helping animals in the wild, and we hope that it is, then anything you can do to keep them robust and healthy and live long, healthy, reproductive lives has got to be good for the overall cause.
Well, I know that in some instances, and I'm drawing a blank on maybe the exact examples, but studying reproductive physiology or studying different diseases that may have come in and could be solved by vaccinations, for example, that if it can be researched in zoos and a protocol established, I know researchers have taken those out to the actual conservation areas, in situ conservation,
true.
And worked with those wild species
to then
work with helping the overall population stay healthy, for example.
Yeah, an example that comes to mind is areas where, and this is a little counterintuitive, but there are some areas in Africa where elephants are overpopulated. And instead of just culling them, one approach has been to castrate the males or castrate many of the males. However, elephant testicles are not descended like most mammals. They are up inside the body like female ovaries. And so it's an abdominal procedure that's 4 feet in to accomplish an elephant surgery like that. And, those techniques were perfected in the zoos,
mm-hmm.
places that where they were appropriate, and then taken out to the field. That's one example. But there's no really any demarcation between wildlife medicine and zoo medicine. I mean, there's a fuzzy line between those two. Some animals that are kept at zoos, you would hope eventually go back out to the wild.
Mm-hmm.
There's not too many cases of that, but there are examples of that.
And there's not, because mainly it's about human use of the area and not that we couldn't reintroduce or train the animals back out to the wild. It's just to keep them safe. There's
the biggest problem with them back too. Yeah, the biggest problem with reintroduction is that there's no place to reintroduce them to.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Mike Berry, we are getting to the end of the show. Is there any last words of wisdom you want to give our listeners?
I think I may have given you all the wisdom I have. I'm not sure.
We covered a lot. I know you're full of stories, but maybe we'll wait for a book one day in your retirement to come out.
Who knows? I've really enjoyed this, though. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
I have, too. Thank you for being on the Peace Brain Show.
You're welcome.
And where can people find out about you? LinkedIn or Facebook or what?
Well, they could find me on LinkedIn or Facebook, I suppose. Yes, I don't. That's a good question. I don't know where they could find out about me.
You're retired, so.
I'm retired, so I'm no longer at the Columbus Zoo.
Right. Well, thank you for being on the Peace Brain Show.
Thank you, Gail.
So everyone, take a breath. We're going to go into the Peace Brain meditation. And I invite you to close your eyes and just settle in your chair wherever you are. And give yourself a grounding cord, that energetic connection between your tip of your spine and the center of the planet. I like to visualize a beam of light coming out of my last vertebrae and going all the way down to the center of Mother Earth. And just allow any tensions or energy that's not yours to flow down the grounding cord and be recycled into Mother Earth. so you can be present right at this moment. And I invite you to see the animals at your zoo. Go to the zoo like you're a little child, really stopping in front of each of these species, each of these animals, and say hello to those animals. And have that delight in your heart. Wow, Mom, I can see a tiger in front of me. Wow, here's a tarantula. Isn't that cool? So remember those times that maybe you were there as a child, and just the childish delight that went through your bones, that excitement of getting to see an animal up close and personally. And take a breath and say hello to that animal. And know that it is being very well cared for. And it is an ambassador for the wild counterparts of its species. Talk to that animal and see what it tells you about its wild cousins and what perhaps you can do to help preserve those species in the wild. Take a moment and choose your favorite animal and ask it, how can I help you and your cousins stay alive and be healthy and be at one with humanity in their natural areas? And just see what answers come to your mind. We are all connected. We are part of this one world. It could be, if you're talking to an orangutan, it tells you to buy products that either do not have palm oil in it, or that are made from a palm oil plantation that is working with conservation of orangutans. Take a moment to research and to thank that animal and to realize that you have the capacity to research how your actions also affect the animals around the planet. And remember the joy you had as a child going through your local zoo. Share that with your family and perhaps your children or grandchildren, that they too can have that joy and that connection. And as Albert Einstein said, that we are not separate, that we are working together, that we are really one universe. One with all the nature and its creatures. Be happy to know that zoos and aquariums are good places. They're places that put education and conservation to the forefront. And that we have amazing veterinarians like Dr. Barry and others, and wonderful keepers and people who truly do love and support these animals in our urban societies. So thank that animal and tell it you can return to it in your mind and your heart at any time and with your feet going to your local zoo or aquarium. And take a breath. And know that you can help preserve conservation. You can help preserve these wild places in your own ways. You do make a difference. And so bring yourself back to your room. Open your eyes. Be in your heart. Send that love out to the animals and the planet. And I thank you for being on the Peace Brain Show today. And listening to my guest, Dr. Michael Barry. And if you want to find out more about me, you can go to tourismforpeace.com or email me at hello at peacebrain.org. And again, I'm happy for you tuning into the Peace Brain Show. This is Dr. Gail Lash, and I want to let you go forth and tell your own stories and create your own places of peace around the planet and get on our World Peace Trails map. So I'm very happy that you can do that yourself and make a difference in this world. Thank you again. Namaste. Many blessings.
Thank you for joining us on the Peace Brain Show. You can find us at tourismforpeace.com. Be sure to check out Dr. Gail's Alchemy of Peace coaching sessions, her Peace Master plans for your business or organization, and her upcoming book, Peace Brain 101. Tune in to BBS Radio Station 2 every other Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific and 8 p.m. Eastern for the Peace Brain Show and your next installment of wonder, inspiration, and practical peace.